Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome to episode 370, entitled Horror and Beauty. My name is Paul Gilmartin. This is the Mental Illness Happy Hour, a place for honesty about all the battles in our heads, from medically diagnosed conditions, past traumas, and sexual dysfunction, to everyday compulsive negative thinking. Basically anything that fucks with us. This show is not meant to be a substitute for professional mental counseling. I'm not a therapist. I'm not a mental health professional. This isn't a clinic. This ain't no doctor's office. It's more like a waiting room that doesn't suck. The website for this show is mentalpod.com. For those of you who are new listeners, I know we were just featured, and I think still being featured on the front page of Apple Podcasts. Welcome. Grab a seat. The fuck am I doing? This show is part interview, part listener confession via the surveys listeners fill out anonymously on our website. And the episode that you're going to hear this week is with two friends of mine from my support group. Regular listeners know that 3 weeks ago, at this roughly this exact same time, I was at my support group with these friends of mine, and it's our weekly group, and there was a shooting outside of our group, and I had to come record the podcast about 45 minutes after that happened. And if you want to listen to that before you listen to this episode, I think three episodes back, number 367 with Jay Larson. The opening 20 minutes of that episode is me describing what happened. So I'm not going to saturate the regular listeners with giving a blow-by-blow of that. But this interview today, conversation, is with two of my friends from this support group who actually were right there when this shooting victim stumbled bleeding into our support group. And I'm not going to explain anymore. That sets the stage for this interview with my friends Jonathan and Mukunda. Before we get to that, I want to read a couple of surveys. This is from the Struggle in a Sentence survey. This is filled out by a woman who calls herself Rose Thorns. And she writes about her love addiction. Maybe if I kill myself, then he will finally care about me. Oh, well summed up. The insanity of addiction, the things that it tells us. This is the same survey. This is filled out by a woman who calls herself when the fart creeps up to the top of the crack and gives a little massage on the way out. That is so observant and horrifying at the same time. But isn't it nice that it has the conscience to give you a little something on the way out? I think it should also just tip you a little nickel right in the crack of your ass. You just hear a tiny voice go, "Hey, get yourself a little something. Here's a little something for the effort. Thanks for eating this spicy food." Anyway, she describes her major depressive disorder. "I feel like I need something so bad. I feel it reaching out from the pit of my stomach, grasping for the thing that it so desperately needs. The emptiness without it is physically painful as much as mental, but I have absolutely no clue what it is that I so desperately need, and the emptiness remains." Wow, what a great description of the emptiness, the void of depression. If more than anything, that's what depression is it's a void. It's an absence. My tooth is starting to do that whistling thing where I sound like a 1890s Western character.
Who wants a sarsaparilla?
About her anxiety, she writes, "It's midnight. You're home alone. You walk to the kitchen and bam, there's a man in all black holding a knife and ready to charge at you. Your heart beats out of your chest and drops to your stomach. You're stuck with unimaginable fear. All of your senses are heightened. You start to dissociate because here is just too painful. Except there is no intruder. There's nothing dangerous at all, actually. But all those feelings and sensations are going full speed. No reason, no apparent trigger, just debilitating flight or fight responses at random, uncalled for times." Oh my God. That is so descriptive. Thank you for that. "About dissociation," she writes, "everything is so unfamiliar. I look at my face in the mirror, look down and touch my hands. I've never seen them before. Watching the movements of my hands confuses me, because how can my body be functioning when I am no longer inside of it?" Thank you for that. This is a same survey filled out by a guy who calls himself Chronic Pain. About his sex addiction, he writes, "I think about masturbating every day until I can finally do it, wherever, whenever. When it's done, I don't know what to focus on for the rest of the day." About his anger issues, "In my head, I fucking hate everyone, even those on the footpath I drive past on the street. I think about killing people every day." Thank you for sharing that. I hope you're... Oh, he does see a therapist, it says here. Keep it up, man. Keep it up. This stuff, trauma and mental challenges and stuff like that, it takes a long, concerted effort to begin to make progress with some of these things. This is filled out by Patrick, who is a trans man, and he writes about his PTSD. "My brain is like a radio trying to listen to my life, but it keeps getting interference from when you threaten to beat me. It's on a loop, fading in and out, sometimes so strong I can't make out which signal is which. It all blends together, becoming a haze of people saying hello and hearing, 'I'll beat you.' People saying, 'I love you,' and it becoming, 'I love you so much, I'll beat this out of you.' You are in every word, every sound, a smashing plate, a car pulling into the driveway. It mixes into a mess of words and beats and sounds that I can't shut off, so loud that I have to close my eyes and cover my ears to try to get through life. It doesn't help. The best I can hope for is the days when it fades to static and I feel nothing." Wow. Thank you for that. And then about experiencing gender dysphoria, he writes, "It's like waking up with a spider crawling on your face, but the spider is boobs." Thank you for that. Thank you. Oh my God. Yeah, you guys just have a way of... I mean, it's why I started this survey, was in my correspondence with listeners, I began to realize that sometimes you guys can put an issue into a sentence that says as much as a 1 hour conversation with somebody does. We've just got a couple more of these and then we'll get to the interview. This is filled out by Jen and she writes about her depression. Something is missing, but I don't know or care what it is. That one, I was just like, oh my God, yes. Yes. That one might be Hall of Fame. And then a snapshot from Jen's life. I remember as a child being at the zoo with my family. I was hot, hungry, and overwhelmed and started crying. My dad looked down at me and said, "You are ruining our family's day," and walked off. And you know, one of the reasons I wanted to read this, Jen, is there is a huge link. I'm not a mental health professional, but I did cook chicken on basic cable for 16 years, and I told dick jokes in mediocre comedy clubs around the country. But there is a link, honestly, between growing up in emotionally invalidating environments and the odds of developing depression. And I wouldn't be shocked if those two are linked in what's happening with you. And ultimately, it's not as important the why of what we're suffering as much as how we move forward, what we can do to get better or to just survive and cope, you know, until it gets to the point where we can enjoy our lives. This is a happy moment filled out by Once a Sunshined Face. And she writes, "It's been over a month since a rough breakup. After realizing I suffer from intense anxiety and a bunch of other miscellaneous things, apparently, I started using BetterHelp and meditation." And BetterHelp is one of our sponsors. "I've been a mess a lot, but here and there making progress. Today was the best day I've had in a long time. This morning I ran 16 miles, five of it with a friend. After the run, my friend and I got coffee and talked for over 2 hours. Turns out he studied psychology and is very hip to the therapy world. He sees one himself. Much conversation was had. Depressed parents, anxiety, darker past than we had ever shared. Honesty about current feelings, all so therapeutic for us both. I felt rejuvenated. Never had I truly enjoyed cooking before. I've been doing it a long time and I can basically do it without thinking. But this next time I cooked, I was being mindful without trying. Just as soon as I realized I was being mindful, I began worrying about an uncomfortable conversation I need to have soon with a loved one. Practice makes progress, I guess. Now my roommate and I are watching Wonder Woman and eating pizza together, whereas I normally hide out. All in all, it's been a good day. P.S. Whenever I fill out the surveys, I type them in your voice. Also, BetterHelp has been really awesome." Of course, which brings me to our sponsor, BetterHelp.com, which is a fantastic online therapy resource. I've been doing it for a year and a half, and I have a great relationship with Donna, my therapist. I talk to her. We video chat every week, and sometimes she'll send me messages during the week and say, you know, here's something to think about, or try to be mindful of this, or ask yourself these questions. And I love it. This week, the thing that she's been talking to me about is the difference between active listening and listening with intent. And I am becoming aware, as much as I hate to admit it, that sometimes when I'm listening, I am sure it's no surprise to people who listen to this podcast, but I get so excited that I have something to share that I stop listening to the person who's talking. And that is not the same as active listening, which is just listening with a clear mind and being present for everything that the person is saying. So that's my new project that I'm working on. And it's probably not a coincidence that I was kicking around on iTunes and I was looking at the reviews of the podcast and somebody gave me a 1 star saying that I think it was the episode with It was the episode with the therapist that we were talking about, Jen Elmquist, talking about couples troubles. And this person was just like, wrote a scathing review, like, you know, who do you think you are, you know, acting like you know everything, and basically validating all the mean shit that I have in my head. But I've been in enough therapy and support groups now to know that dwelling on that and beating myself up about that is not a solution. So what I can do is I can say, well, was there some truth in what that person shared? And I think there was. I think I can be a better listener. And so I make that a goal, but I don't tell myself I'm a piece of shit until I achieve that. So anyway, back to BetterHelp.com. If you're interested in trying it out, go to BetterHelp.com/mental. And it's important to include the /mental so they'll know that you came from their advertisement on my podcast. You'll fill out a questionnaire, and then they'll match you up with a BetterHelp.com counselor, and you can experience a free week of counseling to see if it's right for you. And you need to be over 18, and I love it. All right. Two more quick surveys. This one is struggle in a sentence filled out by a guy who calls himself Wayfaring Taurus, and a snapshot from his life. He writes, getting off the couch for the first time in 2 days to get another bottle of bourbon. And in describing his depression, he writes, it's undiagnosed and untreated. I envy moths. They seek, find, and fly towards the small specks of light in the vast darkness of night. Even if those specks of light are bug zappers. I would imagine that drinking bottles of bourbon is not helping your depression or your ability to feel hope. So I encourage you to maybe deal with that and see how that helps the depression. That was the case with me. I was on my way to killing myself if I hadn't stopped drinking, because I was so depressed. And on paper, I had everything to live for, and I thought about killing myself 50 times a day. So you don't have to feel like that. And then finally, this is a struggle in a sentence, and this was filled out by Oh No. And she gives us, she deals with depression, anxiety, and anorexia, and a snapshot from her life. She writes, my grandmother was cleaning the garden, and a pretty relaxed me came by and asked her, wow, nice work. What's got into you, Mammy? I call her that. And she answered, oh, nothing. That's me. What about you? When are you going to do something? What does your mother think about you doing nothing? And I froze and thought, what a fucking waste I am. Yeah. Look at your grandma who's multitasking. She's gardening and being an asshole.
There's a part of me inside that I don't want anyone to know about because it's weird and gross and lame and people will hate me.
It was so hard to be on the planet.
Just doom, people-pleasing.
Dread.
Silent, invisible.
Just wailing.
Stuck in the grip of the obsession.
Derealization, depersonalization.
A suicidal ideation.
I was so embarrassed and so full of shame.
If I don't get help and get what I need to get...
You know, I did some horrible, horrible things.
Then I'm not going to be here much longer.
God, I wish I could go back and undo them, but I can't.
So snipers would shoot in our sights.
My father was a notorious pimp in Boston.
I can't do this anymore.
It was kind of like Scarface.
You can change somebody's life just by listening.
Through vulnerability, comes healing.
It felt like I'd been holding a sword and shield, and I dropped them. And to this day, I've never had a better night's sleep.
I started crying in a job interview saying, and I was like, LA is hard, man. LA is so hard. And I didn't get that job.
Mukunda and Jonathan are two of the guys, and they're here with me now. They've been nice enough to come talk about what they experienced. I was probably 20 feet away, and it fucked me up. And you guys were right there. And if you're comfortable, obviously you are because you're here, but... Mukunda, why don't you go first and share from the beginning what you experienced. And Jonathan, feel free to chime in wherever you want.
Okay.
I'll chime in now.
Yeah. Oh, and before we do that, yeah. How old are you guys? Kind of what's your background? You know, what are your struggles? That kind of shit. Jonathan, you want to go first? Tell us your background.
Yeah, can you be a little bit more descriptive about background? Like,
yeah.
What do you mean?
How old are you? You know, I know that in the past you were involved in gangs.
Okay.
That you did time in Chino, right?
Is Chino, a couple of different places, but yeah.
Yeah. So if you would, yeah, just kind of.
My name is Jonathan. I'm 32 years old. I grew up in San Fernando Valley. Was like the only white kid in my neighborhood. So I used to get bullied a lot, learn how to fight for myself, so on and so forth. Got involved in gangs. So seeing what happened that night wasn't really like something new. It was something new, like in a sober way for me, you know, because normally I'm like automatically checked out, don't give a shit because I'm loaded or drunk. But did a couple stints in a couple different prisons, not worth mentioning, I would say. Just to check in real quick.
Yeah. So. And you've been sober for a little while now, a couple of years?
Yeah, coming up on 3 years next month.
Yeah. And Jonathan and Mukunda are two guys that have really are such great examples of what can happen to people when they come in and they get honest and they let people help them and how their lives begin to transform, but more importantly, how they learn how to get vulnerable and let that wall down that used to, I suppose, in childhood and adolescence that kept you alive.
Was not allowed. Definitely not. Sign of weakness, you know what I mean? You couldn't be anything other than what everyone else was being, and that's it, you know? Yeah. And if you showed any type of other emotion than, I guess, anger was kind of inappropriate. Because if you smile too much, you're gay. You know what I mean? Yeah. If you're happy too long, you're gay. Or if you were sad, it was like, hey, dude, why don't you drink this or smoke this and shut the fuck up? You know what I mean? That type of deal, you know? Mm. And if I did express that type of shit, real men didn't cry. So what are you talking about?
Yeah.
You know, it was about even when I'm wrong, I kick your ass because I'm right. You know, that type of deal. Yeah.
Mukunda?
My name is Mukunda, 44 years old, born and raised out here in Los Angeles. What happened last week was just insane to me. My background is, I don't know, you know, I'm a compulsive gambler, you know, that's kind of what put me through the fucking ringer in my life. But yeah, what happened last week, just to go to that, we heard shots, right? You know? Yeah, we heard shots. Didn't know if it was a car at first.
I think we all wanted to say it was a car.
Yeah, the first one, you know? Then there was a second one about 3 seconds later. But then after that, it was pop, 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 pop. And, you know, we all got up. I looked. I just happened to be sitting right by the door. And
there's one door in and out of this very small place where support group meetings are held pretty much around the clock. I mean, not after midnight, but dedicated safe space for support group meetings.
And we
meet there every Thursday night at 7:30.
Total place is a total blessing. And this kid comes running in bleeding all over, you know, and walks up the stairs and basically falls down right at my feet, you know. And you know, Jonathan is there, and you know, I'll just say Jay for namesake was there to respond, and
Jimmy, he doesn't mind.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Okay.
And Kevin was the other guy.
And Kevin, yep. Kevin and I'll say Jimmy. I don't even know where to start or where to begin. I just know that Jimmy jumped in, took care of business, and you took care of Mrs. like with his physical things that were going on, like the tourniquet and all that.
I think because when I first heard the shots, I want to say that it was a car, you know, for sure. Mm-hmm. The second one sounded just the same. So I was like, damn, that's a weird, usually don't sound the same, backfire. Yeah. Then I heard another one. Mm-hmm. But then I heard four consecutive more shots, yeah. You know? And that's when I heard you, I'm already standing up, right? Because yeah. I know there's only one door. And I'm like, fuck that. I'm going to try to get out in case this dude try to come in. I mean, I'm sure I'm not the only person that was thinking, you know, that this dude's going to come in and finish the job, you know? At least that's in my mind, you know? Because my lifestyle is like, you're going to get shot. Make sure this fool's dead, you know?
Yeah. How many times do you think you've been shot at in your life?
I don't know, like 3 or 4 times, you know? Fucking chase with knives, bats, you know, all that type of stuff, you know what I mean? I'm usually like, even when that happened, it was weird for me to be in that situation and not be prepared, you know, like I've always had something, like, or grabbed something to defend myself with. I felt completely naked, and going back to the meeting tonight reminded me of, like, you know, I stopped carrying even a knife in sobriety, you know what I mean? Like, I just don't do that no more, because that's not who I am, and I have a higher power that protects me, you know. But leaving for that one moment, my own thinking comes kicking back in, you know, my own thinking, and I'm like, oh man, I gotta do something.
Yeah, you know. Yeah, it was I said dial 911, you know. He came in, and as soon as I saw him, that was it. My whole world was him. I didn't see anything else or anybody else. I just saw, you know, Jimmy jump up and kind of take care of him physically, you know, asking for a belt. I took off my belt and threw it at him. Kevin gave him his belt. He started attending to his wounds and to his tourniquet. But I had the young man, 22 years old, basically, as far as, like, I'm looking at my hand right now, it's about, you know, 8-10 inches, about a foot away. That's how close I was to him in his face. And I was just trying to comfort him. He was in a state of shock.
He was making a lot of noise.
He was shot. Pain. You know, I mean, fuck, he shot twice.
Shot twice, and he was loaded. You know.
Yeah, and
he was on a 2-day meth run.
Yeah.
Fuck. Apparently.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I remember seeing Makunda saying, "Oh shit, it's happening right here," and I seen him when he come running in, and like I kind of want to see like this dude, like, because I'm already trying to sidestep coming in, and but I remember his like hand, like almost it felt like it like fell into your his face fell into your hand.
Yeah, he did.
You know what
he
I mean?
Did.
Like
yeah,
he caught it. Like I got you. You know.
Yeah,
what I mean?
It just so came. It was like, to his, yeah. His, yeah.
And then I think in that moment for me it was slow mo, and it was like, do I help him or do I go? Mm. You know what I mean? And I remember just putting my hands on his leg and like trying to hold the blood in, you know. Then Jamie came back in.
Yeah.
So I get the fucking belt.
right.
And he had been shot in his femoral artery, right?
Yeah, like up top, almost by his
groin
area. Mm. You know what I mean? It was pretty high up there.
And it was really coming out.
It was at first, because it didn't look that bad as he ran in, but once he laid down, you could see it just boom, and like, oh damn, someone got to grab this.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's when I guess I placed my hands on top of him, and that's when I was waiting for Jamie kicked in. It's like, hey, let's do this. Give me a belt. And we tried. He tried doing the tourniquet, and that was held off.
Mm.
And it was just, I guess, dramatic. It seemed slow mo, but it seemed like, you know, it just seemed like.
I remember Kevin was holding one of his hands. Kevin was holding his hand. I was supporting his head. You know, and it was surreal.
It was totally
surreal. And you know, several times, 3 or 4 times, he looked me directly in the eye and was like, don't let me die. I don't want to die. You know, and he said a young lady's name, you know, his girlfriend, or he talked about his mom, little. And I was just there just trying to comfort him to the best of my ability, you know.
I think a couple times, too, you pulled his face close to yours, like, don't, just calm down, just calm down. Like, head to head, like, just calm down, just, like, calm down. And it was like, it was crazy, man. Just seeing his reaction and seeing everyone else's reaction around us too. And it was like at that one moment we were able to like tone out everything else and help this dude, you know. And like talking about it now, I haven't really had a chance to really talk to anyone about it besides my sponsor, right after the meeting afterwards. And at that time, that's when all my emotions kicked back in. And like for a moment, I was definitely not concerned about me.
Yeah,
but then when my shit kicked back in, it was crazy, man. Like, it was a roller coaster effect, and I don't know. I'm just tripping out now because it's like really the first time I had a chance to like sit here and actually play the real through. You know what I mean?
Mm.
I think because more or less I've been emotionally trying to fill out where I'm at, because I work with kids, you know, and I'm like, man, I can't be like that when I'm around them. Like, and I've been trying to put my emotions into check. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But fuck, that shit was scary, huh? Like, thinking about it, like, I'm trying to remember, like, this dude's going to come to the door, too. You know what I mean?
Right. Somebody else actually ran up behind him. This person put his hands up to signify he didn't have a gun. And he ran into the lobby. I think he saw the whole commotion. And, you know, next thing I know, he wasn't there. But it wasn't a consideration. You know, I don't know if I was the first one to see him, but I remember seeing him, and I remember yelling to everybody, dial 911, dial 911. And then he just walked up the stairs and literally fell, like, right at my feet, like, right at our feet where we were sitting. And it was just, for 10 minutes, it was just me and him, you know? And I was just grateful that I was able to respond in hindsight, you know, like, my mom, I told my mom about it. She's like, did you pray for him? Did you, you know? I was like, you know, just being there, I think, is like, is enough. You know what I mean? Like, if, you know, I believe in God, and I believe God was there.
No,
you know,
he definitely
comforting
was.
Him,
yeah.
You know, through us. I'm like Jonathan, because when it was over, I called my best friend, and it brought me back to the times I've been shot at. You know, I've been shot at a couple times. I have guns pulled on me 4 or 5 times in my life. I got robbed, you know, several times at gunpoint. There was actually a point in my life where I used to rob people at gunpoint, you know. And there's something about those situations where everything slows down for me, and I don't freak out. I don't know why. You know, one time I got shot at like 4 or 5 times, but it was in front of my friends, or the guy who's shooting at me was in front of his mom's house. So I knew he was just trying to intimidate me. But it brought all that back to me. You know, I talked, I replayed all that, and it just pissed me off, you know?
How so? Can you be more specific about how it brought all that back to you?
Well, the bleeding and all that stuff, it just brought back like events where I could have been shot, or like events like that, and just
in terms of the images, the emotion.
I think the emotion, the adrenaline, was it. You know, or even the low key adrenaline, because like you're hyped. You know, like I couldn't sleep. I can't let that happen. What, Thursday night? No. I didn't sleep Thursday night. I didn't sleep Friday night. I couldn't sleep. I tried to sleep Friday night. Thursday night, I just stayed up all night. It wasn't until like Saturday that I actually slept, and it wasn't until Monday that I got it out of my system, you know, because that was with me, you know, for 2-3 days. I couldn't shake the images out of my mind. I couldn't shake his face out of my mind, like the blood everywhere and him looking me in the eyes and like, you know, saying, I don't want to die. Like that I couldn't, it shook me. But by the grace of God and by like our fellowship, I was able to like let that go on Monday, just a few days later. But like, you know, my heart goes out to like EMT people who see stuff like that every day.
Yeah.
The trauma of it, insane.
That's one of the things I said when I recorded and talked about it last week was, when I drove home, and I was 30 feet away from what you guys were experiencing, I felt like I wasn't fully in my body. Like my brain, like I'd been up for 3 days. That's what my brain felt like. And I thought, how do people deal with that
every day? Yeah. And sober.
Maybe he did not. You know, I don't know.
You know what I mean? Like, wow.
I don't know if I could do that. Wow.
Did you have any thoughts as, and probably not when you were tending to this guy, but afterwards, about what the old you would have done, or things that the old you had done that weren't necessarily helpful, like in this way, and get see your growth? Or is that something that hasn't really occurred to you? Because I see it in you guys.
One moment I want to say that I felt sad for him, but my emotions did came back in, like I wanted to tear up, and then like And that's at the, don't get me wrong, that's at the same time I was like, I gotta get out of Dodge, you know? And that's like, in my mind, I think I had to leave, but I didn't see anything anyways, right? That's when my old behavior kicked in real quick, you know? Mm. But I was trying to leave, but that's the insanity of it, right? Let's just leave. I don't want to talk to any cops, you know?
I don't have anything
to offer anyways, but I gotta go because they want to talk to me.
Oh, you mean you didn't see anything like who shot him?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because you don't want to go to court.
Yeah, you see what I'm saying? And I really didn't know anything about that anyways, but I did feel sad for a moment. But afterwards, like, knowing that I had, like I said, I had jobs to rely on, too. But, like, I'm feeling my own emotions. I'm talking about it. And it does feel surreal, especially when I go to a fellowship every week. And, like, out of all places, I mean, yes, we live in L.A., but out of all places, like, I'm gonna find this here. You know?
Right. Like, yes.
You know, and right. This is where I came to get away from all that.
Right.
You know? So I would say, like, that type of old stuff brought in for me. But I do want to say, like, I feel for the kid. And it's a, like, for me, here goes, like, I feel bad saying this, but it's a doggy dog world, you know? And like this, if you're going to play that game, like, these, there's consequences to it. And I think anyone in that room, let it be an old timer or a newcomer, has the faintest idea that you're not going to die out there. Like, that's solid proof right there. That it doesn't have to be the dope sack or the bottle, bro, you know?
Yep.
So, for me, it's like, we all make these choices, and it is what it is, you know? And yeah, I feel bad for him, you know? I feel bad for him, but that's the life you're choosing to live. That's why I left, you know? Like, I'm done. I'm a two striker. I'm not trying to catch my third, you know?
Yeah.
I got sober, and like, I'm not only did I get sober on my sober day, that's the last day I was in jail. So I say every time I catch my cake, like, or catch my cake. You'll take it. Like, I'll get you the term, right?
We got to explain that to the listener. Explain the two terms that you mixed up.
Like, catch my cake and take my cake?
Yeah, and catching a case.
Oh, and catching a case.
Yeah,
sure.
That's what I thought you were mixing up. Because
No, I say, well, catch a cake, because now I'm catching cakes instead of catching cases, you know?
Sure.
I'm a cake dealer now, not a dope dealer. Right. You know what I mean?
But one of the things in Southern California, in Southern California, one of the traditions is when you have an anniversary of your sobriety, your friends present you with a cake, and people sing happy birthday, and it's a big deal.
Yeah.
We call that taking a cake. And the other phrase among people who've been in prison a lot is
about to catch a case, fool.
Catch a case. When you've been arrested,
break out.
People never say I got arrested or I got caught. They say I caught a case.
Oh,
and so you said, yeah, I caught a cake, which was fucking fantastic.
But yeah, man. So like, I'm fighting for my freedom as much as I'm fighting for my sobriety is what I'm trying to say. You know what I mean? And like, they coincide for me. You know what
Absolutely.
I mean? They really do. Like, I remember
life,
you picking me
death.
Up. Yeah, exactly. Like, you helped save my life. You know what I mean? And so, really, you helped save that guy's life too.
Wow.
You know what I mean? Like, you brought me there. You're the reason why. You know what I mean? Like, I was just a product of finding out what you found. But I would have never got that if your higher power didn't work from you, you know, or mine, whatever the case may be, you know? But you helped in that.
That's so funny, because I was thinking how useless I was in that moment, that I was just standing there kind of stunned and not terrified, because there was 30 people between me and the doorway. So just logistically, I knew
I'm good.
That guy's not bringing in three clips.
Right, right.
You know,
right,
I'm
right.
good.
That sounded like a handgun. I'm
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. But
I don't know about the guy in front of me, but you know, fuck it.
I joked with one of our friends. I said, you know, I immediately looked for you because I needed a shield.
I bet you I know who that was.
I'm grabbing old timers first, put them up front. They lived a good life.
I'm trying to get there.
But I think one of the things
that
we do, and I don't think it's necessarily just addicts or alcoholics, but we look for the most negative, beat yourself up way of looking at things.
Real talk.
And after this thing happened, was there anything that you said to yourself, thought to yourself? Did you just kind of brush it out of your mind? Were you able to say, you know, I did what I could? And by the way, the guy, from what we understand, survived.
Okay.
But
good.
Absolutely, because
good.
You guys had your fucking fingers in the guy's wounds that were gushing blood. I looked up there at one point, and Jonathan, you had blood. You had a short sleeve shirt, and you had blood above your elbow, completely covering your arms.
I said, because it took a second to find the hole. I had to move him, and he was screaming.
Yeah,
and I had to move him to find out, because I seen that entry from the pants, but I had to find where it was coming.
Where
Jimmy
it was had
coming
to flip
from.
Him a little bit too.
That was the second part, because once I found the wound, that's when he came with the belt, and that's when we knew where to put it. But that's when he lifted the leg up, and we tried readjusting it, and at that point, it was done.
Where do you put a tourniquet when somebody's shot in the groin?
Above it.
Above it. There's not much room.
In the groin?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, you want to try to get as close as you can to it, you know what
I
mean? You want to try to, like, stop the bleeding, you know?
Right.
And if it has to be on top, then let it be on top.
But
the fact is, you need to get it up there. It's always above the wound, you know?
Mm.
But if you could tie off the wound itself, then cool. But you got to remember where your blood's coming from, you know?
Yeah.
coming from the top of our body. So
now, see, that's something. I'm from the suburbs. That's not that. That's like not something that I've ever had to really think about.
Gotcha.
And that's one of the things that struck me when you guys were up there was I was thinking these guys have experience with this, but in such a different way.
For sure. Mm.
Friends being shot, you being shot at, or even just thinking, what am I going to do? You know, we're going into dangerous territory. I might get shot. Mm. What am I going to do? I've never had to think about that.
Yeah, no, I grew up carrying a gun. You know what I'm saying? You know, like I said, I used to rob folks at gunpoint.
And if it
wasn't
a gun, it was a screwdriver or something.
Yeah, so I guess I was used to kind of that trauma. I was used to delivering that trauma to people. You know, not actually shooting people, but seeing that terrified look on people's faces when you put a gun in their face. You know, you put a gun in the face of a couple in Larchmont Village or in Westwood. You know, they never see that shit coming. You know. And like the complete horror and terror that you would see that people realize, like this gun that I'm holding in my hand actually could take your life. And to see that in somebody's face, like I did that to somebody, I caused somebody to have that terror. Like, I think I got it out of my system, but I'll never quite get those looks of those people. You know what I mean? There's a couple I did that to, and there was an older woman I did that to, and I'll never forget those looks.
Yeah, and
never,
I'm sure.
And those
I'm sure,
shrieks as well. I'll never forget that.
And I'm sure they won't.
I know. It's fucking, it's horrible.
And how do you, how does that weigh on you? How do you find a way to make peace with your past, if at all?
With that, I've made peace with, because unlike Jonathan, I didn't grow up gangbanging or into it. So for me, it was a season. For me, it was like a year period of my life, you know, where I was living this kind of violent lifestyle, doing these things, robbing people at gunpoint for like a 2-3 month period. But it was every night. It was insane. But
was this to pay for something? For...
No, I was 18 or 19. Well, you know what? No, it actually was. I mean, I was like, you know, opened up a dope house in South Central, a crack spot. I was selling crack. And we just wanted money, you know? And there's something about when you have no guidance or direction at that age that you're fucking crazy. You could be reckless, wilding, running the streets. And I was like that since I was 15. But at 18 and 19, it became a whole new thing with guns and armed robbery. And, you know, I made peace with it because of kind of what happened last Thursday. I've had moments in my life where God has used me. So just like I've been an instrument for delivering terror to people, God's used me to be an instrument of, you know, encouraging people. Or just this last summer, I was working with kids in a criminal justice system for a little bit.
That's right.
And I was able to kind of pass that on a little bit as well. So by the grace of God, I never had to pull the trigger. And, you know, there's this one time I got robbed near Beverly Center by some SAs. You know, they got me for my White Sox hat. You know, I was fucking, and I was, when I was robbing folks and I came back, I knew the patterns of, you know, armed robbery. I knew they were still looking for people because I didn't have any real money. And I saw their car and I pulled up behind them. The dude was wearing my White Sox hat and I had my gun on me. And I was like, man, I'm about to blast the fuck up out of this car. But I was like, you know, some major thoroughfare. And I was like, okay, I'm going to double back. I saw they parked their car and I looked for them because I knew they were in the neighborhood just like they got me. I knew they were in the neighborhood walking around trying to get somebody. And I went through the alleyway looking for them and I would have fucking shot them. I would have shot him, and by the grace of God, I didn't see him. So I went back by their car and I shot the windows out of their car, and you know, I took off.
And you wound up bringing food onto the table for somebody that works at an auto body shop. So it really,
yeah, I don't, you know, this. I'm just grateful that I never, that is by the grace of God, that I never hurt anybody.
So they were robbing people and they had robbed you?
They robbed me.
I got you. Okay.
Yeah, they robbed me. Yeah.
Jonathan, is he was talking and sharing about that, about having brought terror to people, what were you thinking or feeling, if anything?
It's just like...
The look you just gave me when I said that, Jonathan kind of shook his head with I don't know how to describe it, but like
I try not to think about this stuff, you know, like I talk to like a certain person about it. But yeah, man, like I said, like when I say like it's a doggy dog world, it's like, you know, like I at that, like in that mode, like I really believe it, you know, and like I've done things that I feel bad for. And there's just some things that I like I didn't feel bad for because like it was what it was, and like it'd rather be me than you, you know, or rather be you than me. But like robberies, yeah, that comes with the world, you know what I'm saying? Especially when you're selling dope, you know, you never have enough dope money. And if you see an easy lick, you want to take it. But like, I remember having like a tweaker, man. He was doing credit card fraud and shit like that. And I remember I didn't even need a gun. I just had like one of those hot wire things, you know, that you check radio cords with, you know, and you see if it's working and the light turns on in the back, just put it to his neck. Like, dude, get the fuck in the car. About to stab my homeboy because he wouldn't drive fast enough. And like, I know the fear that I put into people, you know, and like, and it drove me for a very long time. There was a man in the rooms, Brian, right? Mm-hmm. And he told me the respect that I was looking for when I first got sober is going to send me back to prison. And that dude hit it straight on the head. Like, he couldn't have said it any better, you know?
So when you say the fear was driving you, meaning your actions were driven by fear?
Saying is I fed off your misery in a sense if I was causing it, you know, because like I wanted what you had and I never could have got it without by myself, you know. And like this is coming from a kid growing up in a home, you know what I mean, where my dad's like beating my ass every day in a sense, and like the only time he wouldn't is when I'm doing shit like that, you know what I mean, where I'm burglarizing houses and bring it back to him so he can go cluck it off so he can go get high.
Wow.
You know what I mean? And like the only time I would get in trouble is if I got caught type deal. You know?
Wow. Yeah. I didn't know that about you.
Well, it's just like, because like, look, like I feel like I'm glorifying some of my behavior and then it makes me become a victim also. Like I'm a victim, but I'm not a victim because of that. And not only because of 18, but I make my own choices now. You know what I mean? And like at one point in my life, this is the only way I knew how to live.
Yeah.
And that for a long time, I blamed God. I said, why are you going to consequent me for making me the person that I am? You know? And for a long time, I had a resentment because it told me straight up. It said, this is the only defense against a first pickup or use is a spiritual one, man. And I remember having a deep sense of, fuck, I'm screwed. I remember walking into my counselor's office in tears and told her, I don't think I'm going to make it. You know what I mean? And this is after you picked me up already. I already left Cry Help and went back to Tarzana, you know?
Those are rehabs that he's talking about. Yeah, no, that's all right.
I didn't think I was going to make it. And like, the only way I knew how was by doing the way that I was doing. And the crazy part, the insanity part of it is convincing me that I was still making it, doing the shit that I was doing, and I wasn't making shit. You know what I mean? Like, where I'm at right now, I'm grateful for it. Like, where I'm at right now, I was able to help someone else. Because the old me being in that position would have walked out the front door and stepped over him. Real shit. I'm out of here. You know what I mean? But where I'm at today, like, I'm able to be present enough to help another person. You guys taught me that's what you're supposed to do, and like you gotta get that doing esteemable acts builds self-esteem, and like I feel good about these things, you know. And it's not just about that one instance, it's about all the other lives that I've affected due to the people in the rooms that affected mine, you know what I mean. And I think that's where the bigger picture is, because I don't think that dude would have even had that opportunity if no one in that room had affected Jamie, had affected you, or affected me, or affected Kevin.
No, the old me would have walked away. The old me would have been looking for the shooter. The old me would have been ducking, and the old me would have got the fuck out of there and let everybody else deal with that shit. That ain't none of my business. You know, that's none of my business. But the new me doesn't even have to think about it. The new me is like, it just, somebody's in need. Then that's it.
How can I help?
I'm just going to do whatever I can to help. You know.
And to me, one of the things that speaks to is the power of addiction. That it can, because to me, these are the authentic. This is the authentic Mukunda, and this is the authentic Jonathan. But without tools to cope with our environment or our emotions, we give into addiction. We give in to anger, fear, whatever.
We want something to mask it up.
Sure.
Yeah.
I still give in to anger. I still have fucking rage outbursts. Sure. Yeah.
And also not understanding that we're powerless over
And sometimes it even has to do with anything I feel. Like, I could feel a certain way, and I'm allowed to feel that way as long as I just don't act out because of the way that I'm feeling. It's like the biggest tool that I have. Like, yeah, you feel like the way you do, but you don't got to be an asshole to everybody else. You know what I mean?
I've remembered so
many. Still working on that part.
So many times I remember you sitting in the back row, Jonathan, early on in your sobriety, and you talking about how fucking angry you were and how scared you were that this wasn't going to work out, this new way of life, and you guys better not be fucking lying to me. Jonathan just made the sign of the cross. And
man.
And we saw you grow, man. We saw you start to let your walls down and go. You went back to school, right?
Yeah.
And you were terrified that you weren't going to be able to.
Oh, no. I remember calling, I'm saying everyone's name now, putting all you guys on blast, Terry, right?
Yeah.
I remember crying in the school parking lot with my fiance, at the time it was my girlfriend, saying I don't think I was going to make it. I was so scared to walk through those doors.
Hmm.
You know, and like, for this fucked up, man, but low key for so long, like, I was waiting for shit to hit the fan. Like, things were going too good for me in the program. Like, the way you guys were telling me to do it, and I'd, even though I'd kick my feet, I'll do it, and it always worked out. But since the good things kept happening, and the price and the fear for me kept getting, like, man, something is bound to happen. You remember those shares? Like, shit's gonna hit the fan. Things are going too well.
And we would laugh. And we would all laugh.
You know what I mean? But, like, nothing's happened. Like, like they said, like, just stay present, man. Stay in the solution and you'll be all right. And that's what I think I've been doing, man. Like, I remember Jamie, too, said, you helped save this guy's life tonight. And I turned around and I told him, not to be, like, cliche, but I told him, I said, don't we save guys' lives every night? Like, in the rooms, you know what I mean? Like, we really do, though. You know what I'm saying? And, like, I'm just glad that I have actual evidence now, not just come in as a newcomer, but actual evidence now, like, this thing does work. Like, because remember when you come in, you're like, I don't know. like I'm telling you, you're repeating my shares. Like, I really didn't know, but I have actual evidence now to show me when I get direction, to show me, like, what happens when I take direction. Like, this is what happens when you take direction. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, well, I wouldn't turn it in for a world. Knock on wood, you know, because it's scary. Who knows what might happen tomorrow, but as long as I don't pick up.
Amen.
So after this happened, what have you experienced just in terms of emotions or your thinking or, you know, kind of the PTSD-ish stuff? I know it's hard to know what you having a shitty day or being angry or whatever.
I know that, like, the trauma of it, I got out of my system in like 4 days. I got it out like on Monday, and is by the grace of being able to share it at different fellowship meetings. But yeah, PTSD is a real thing, you know.
And it may, from what I understand about it, it may come back. It may never fully be gone. I could be wrong, but
But I got that sense, you know what I mean? Because there was something that, like I said, I couldn't sleep, and that his face and his shock and all that blood. And him looking at me in the eye and say, don't let me die. And him saying, mom, you know, he said mom like 3 or 4 times. And just literally face to face with him for like about 10 minutes before, you know, the ambulance got him. And seeing, you know, but he, you know, he actually, it worked. Like what you did, what Jimmy did, what Kevin did.
And by the way, we interchange Jimmy and Jamie.
Yeah.
He kind of gets called both names. But
It worked after a couple minutes of him freaking the fuck out. He got shot, you know, and in shock, like, he was calming down, you know, like, our presence there actually worked, you know. Somebody said that, like, a lot of people, when they get shot, if nobody's around, they go into shock and bleed out because they're freaking the fuck out. And we were able to calm him down enough to... You know, he's 22 years old, and it made me think later on that night that I have a daughter who's 22 years old, you know, about the same age, you know, like fucking, you know, I feel like a kid myself, but the fact is I'm not a kid, you know what I mean? Well, I mean, maybe I am, I don't know, age is so relative, but, you know, like, it opened my eyes, like, fuck, I got a 22-year-old, you know? And
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, it's just, I don't know. My heart goes out to people who see this stuff on a nightly basis.
I can't imagine. I can't imagine. And Jonathan, how about you? Since the event, what's been coming up for you? Anything that you haven't talked about or shared here?
I just, like, the most emotions that I think, like, because of this self-help or self-support group that mm-hmm. we have, I mean, just being able to rely on people. I think, like, once I left the meeting, I called my sponsor. My roommate took me to a meeting. My sponsor met me up, you know what I mean? And we chopped it up. I think because he was there right when all the emotions were coming back, and I knew that I had to talk to someone knowing that I was going to be gone for a long weekend, right, because of work. Mm. Helped me out a lot. Mm. The next morning, it was waking up to go to work, though, I remember getting into a little argument with my fiance, you know, and I was like, yeah, I knew that. I know I'm being an asshole, I'm just being a grouch, but I know it's because of what happened that night. You know what yeah, I mean? Like, yeah. For real, like, okay, like, I want to be like, don't you know just what happened? Like, give me my space. Yeah. But I gotta remember I'm in real life. You know yeah. what I mean? Like, and I can be that way, but the results of me being that way all the time are not good. But I want to say, like, low-key, wholeheartedly, like, I feel grateful to be alive.
Amen.
Grateful to be yeah. like a part of what we did, be able to be a part of, you know, and like grateful for people like Pauly, man. Like, I seriously believe, like, if you didn't probably take me, I probably wouldn't have been there.
Hmm.
You know what I mean?
So Paul was the first one to take you to the meeting?
Yeah, the first one. That's why I kept. Nice. I've met my sponsor there. Okay. I've kept coming yeah. back. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But you know what I'm saying? So it's like people like you guys, man. Well, people like you, I'm gonna say, you help too. I really believe that, man. I don't think this was only just me, you know?
No.
I mean, I could take all the credit, but that don't sit well for me, you know?
No.
Well, I'm happy that just eventually you were able to make it about me.
You ain't lying. I'll say one thing, too. I give more credit to people that it could be there for people in real life, you know, when it's like you're inconveniencing yourself to be there for somebody. This was just a situation that happened in front of me where I had to react and respond to it. Gotcha. You know, I wish, you know, and I'm not, I could be there for people and I have been, but I give a lot more respect to people that go out of their way to go get people, to call on people, to check on people. You know what I mean? I think that's a way bigger form of giving. Yeah. Than just being in a situation where you end up being of service, but to go out and look to be of service, you know, like you do and like other people do in this world, like those are like the real, in my mind, like, you know, where it's at, you know.
Because if you could hear my mom right now, she'd probably be saying, you saved my son, too.
Hmm.
Real shit. You know, you never met my mom, but I'm sure she would tell you that.
Yeah.
Hmm.
That she told Patrick, you know.
Wow.
Hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, you saved me from a life sentence or death out there, man. Like, there's no hint about I'm going to go to prison for life. Like,
hmm.
I'm eternally grateful, you know?
I'm grateful for you guys.
You're a motherfucking miracle.
So are you, man. Like, that's what this whole room has, man.
Amen.
Thank you guys for coming and sharing about that and being my friends.
Thank you, brother.
What?
Thanks, love you guys.
Friends.
Huh? What's that?
So grateful to have those guys in my life. Before I take it out with some more surveys. And by the way, for those of you that are new to the podcast, generally, the surveys can get pretty, pretty dark. And I usually, move those, towards the end of the show. So, you know, I know sometimes people get triggered and their people will write and say, you know, you should put trigger warning, you know, my entire podcast, you know, could technically have a trigger warning on it. So the best I can do is try to have the really heavy stuff towards the end. But for a lot of people, that's the stuff that they find the most compelling or even comforting. There's a lot of us that find comfort in hearing things that are dark or heavy, because I think it reminds us that we're not the only ones that are, you know, struggling. Before I get to those, I just want to remind you guys there's a couple of different ways to support the podcast, if you feel so inclined. You can do it financially by making a one-time donation through PayPal. The link is on our website. Or you can become a monthly donor through Patreon, which is you can do for as little as a dollar a month. And sky's the limit.
You could donate $5 million a month. I want you to seriously consider that, please, each of you. And that is the backbone that this podcast depends upon. And we need monthly donors. Advertisers kind of come and go. And the bedrock is the monthly donors. And if you subscribe through Patreon, I can sometimes give bonus content or silly stuff from my life. I'll post it there. Sometimes I have raffles for events and stuff like that and give stuff away. So, and I'd like to say stuff one more time. Fucking idiot. Yeah, so all those links are on the website. You can also help us by going to iTunes, giving us a good rating, writing something nice, or spreading the word about the podcast through social media. And you can buy a t-shirt or a coffee mug and find all that shit at the website. We got some really good t-shirts. Okay. This is a struggle in a sentence filled out by Slug Boy, who is gender fluid, and they write about their love addiction. Adore me, worship me, but no, I will never love you back. You're just the lift driver between here and the real thing. But I might as well bleed your heart dry like mine in the process. About codependency, or dating a codependent specifically. For the love of God, stop touching me. Leave me alone. Let me sit on the opposite end of the couch. Stop staring at me. Stop hovering over me in the mirror. Give me one day, 1 hour, 1 minute to myself before I claw my skin off and feed it to you. But why don't you just leave him? Oh, well, that would just be mean. Thank you for that. Oh, the insanity of codependence. This is a really touching email that I got from somebody, and I'm a bit confused by it, so I wanted to get your guys' take on it. I'll just read it to you. Oddly enough, it starts off, it says, thank you. Thank you. It's my pleasure. Excuse my instruction into your private life without your prior permission. I hope my mail will not cause you much embarrassment as I write to you in good faith. I know this message might come to you as a surprise because you don't know me in person, but it is only God that brought us together. This did catch me by surprise. I actually fell. I was riding a horse when I read this. I always like to read my emails when I'm on horseback, and I fell off the horse, but I'm okay. My names are Miss Maria Allen. That's so funny because I would have counted that as one name. This is very confusing. I am the regional chief account manager of one of the prime bank here in Burkina Faso. I am 32 years old, lady, single. I am woman of peace, and I don't want problems in my life. Here's the bind for me. She is a woman of peace, and she sounds intriguing and trustworthy, but I'm a man of war. I don't know how we're going to get along, and I don't know what it is exactly that she wants from me, so I'm going to read on. It is my duty to send in a financial report of my customers to our head office in the capital at the end of each year. But in the course of the last year, 2017 fiscal report, I discovered that one of my foreign customer late, and then a parenthesis, Honorable Mr. Ghazi al-Sadiq Abdel Rahim, that's so funny, that's my middle name, who died during the Sudan crash on 9 August 2012. I feel like an asshole because I apparently missed in the news about the Sudan crash. You would think that when an entire country crashes, it would be in the news for long enough for me to know about that. Anyway, and I'm also beginning to think that there is an unusually high death rate of wealthy, honorable people in Burkina Faso in the last 10 years. And I think we should get a private investigator. Anyway, here's the important part that I need your guys' help on. My head office are not aware of it, and it will never be aware of this transaction. He was a business magnate and Sudanese government's religion minister. He deposited the sum of $17,300,000. You guys, that is a lot of money. This fund have been placed in what we call escrow call account with no beneficiary. As an officer of this bank, I cannot be directly connected to this money, so my aim of contacting you is for you to assist me to receive this money in your country through your bank account and get 50% of the total funds as commission slash share, while 50% for me. That seems like a shitty split. That really does. You know, when I first read this, my thought was 90 fucking 10 or I walk. And then I realized I don't really have to do much to get this money, but I'm still in a bind. Let me continue. Please, please, I beg of you, be patient with me. Since you are from another country outside Burkina Faso, this, I don't know if you guys know this, but there are other countries inside Burkina Faso. It's a very confusing place to drive. I need your cooperation to stand as the next of kin to the defunct customer of our bank who died in the crash. I had a friend who is sadly now defunct. I don't want to go into the reasons why, but I have every information about this money, and I will be backing you up with information that can make you claim the money from our bank, but you will not tell anybody in my bank that the information is from my side. By virtue of my position, I can guarantee that we stand a great chance of success. If you're interested, please indicate your willingness to initiate the process by contacting me via email to enable us to discuss the terms and conditions under which this transaction would be carried out. I just think she seems nice. And she used formal names. There's a lot of misters and misses and people in high positions of authority. And it just, something about this just feels right. So I actually don't need your help. I've figured it. I've walked myself through it. And hopefully by this time next month, I will have about $8 million. In the bank, and I won't be doing this podcast. So good luck to all of you. This is a struggle in a sentence filled out by Tom, and he writes about his depression, talking myself into doing things every day because the worst case scenario, I die, in any situation is also the best case scenario. That's one of the awesome things about, probably the only awesome thing about being suicidal. When I was suicidal, I didn't mind turbulence on airplanes. That's about the only bonus about his anxiety. Even mundane everyday situations feel like you're performing with a band at Carnegie Hall in front of thousands of people and everyone got the sheet music except for you. Thank you for that. Diana Ross, oh, I didn't know she's a listener, describes her depression like my whole body is sinking into the bed and every thought is way too bright. That one might be Hall of Fame. That is fantastic. Thank you for that. Major depressive overachiever describes her love addiction. Looking at almost every man I come into contact with and thinking of how you could take care of them, you're what they've been missing their entire lives. This is from the babysitter survey, and this was filled out by a woman who calls herself Beardy. And she writes, I think I was helping a friend babysit. Some boys showed up. My friend and I are female. I remember the little boy was laying on his bed and we were all taking turns abusing him, pulling down his pants, touching him. I can't remember what else. And then to the question, did you tell anyone? Did you think it was normal? Do you believe it had any effect on you? No, I didn't tell anyone. I was very aware it was wrong, but I was frozen because of my own issues. I just watched, fascinated. Remembering these things, what feelings come up? Sadness, regret, and shame. Do you feel any damage was done? I'm not sure, but I wish not. Maybe the child doesn't remember, but how horrible. If you are a parent, has your experience or experiences influenced how you view your children being babysat? I do not trust babysitters. And she is, obviously it happened when she was, a teenager. And she's now in her 40s. And thank you for sharing that. Those of you that are new to the podcast, one of the things that I began to notice a lot reading people's surveys, especially the shame and secrets survey, which I'm about to read one of in a second, I began to notice that a lot of people had been abused by babysitters as children. And so I created that survey, the babysitter survey. This is the Shame and Secrets survey, and this is filled out by a guy who calls himself Flapping in the Wind. He is straight, in his 30s, raised in a pretty dysfunctional environment. He's never been sexually abused. He's not sure if he was physically or emotionally abused. And he writes, I think my mother crossed a few lines raising me. She was not shy about bringing strange men home and fucking them. Once I caught her getting banged on the living room couch. I was about 10 at the time. That is a form of sexual abuse. I don't know how to put words to say how I would categorize that, but exposing your children to your sexuality is, you know, there's something that would be, you know, the kid accidentally walked in while we were fucking. That's an accident. People make mistakes. But fucking on the couch while your 10-year-old is in the house, that is a form of sexual abuse. And the fact that you just describing this one event, things like this, I've never seen it where somebody does something like that and it's an isolated incident. So anyways, continuing. Darkest thoughts. I like looking at teen girls in public. I would easily have sex with an underage girl if I could find one willing. Darkest secrets. Just today, I trespassed into my landlord's apartment. We share a dwelling with the intent to steal a pair of her underwear. I was successful. It's the first time I have done this since moving in a year and some ago. But I've thought about her every time I have masturbated in the last 6 or 7 months. I don't think this will escalate further, but I'm not positive on it, and it kind of freaks me out. Part of me couldn't wait to share this on here. I feel like I'm fighting a losing battle with sex addiction. Sexual fantasies most powerful to you. Anything involving teen girls and or anything that involves a woman's feet. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? I miss you. I'm sorry. Also, I'm fucked and kind of scared. What, if anything, do you wish for? Lately, I'd give anything to be comfortable with who I am. I want the constant sex thoughts and fantasies to go away so I can focus on more important matters. Have you tried sharing these things with others? No, I tried a therapist in the past but couldn't be totally open, and I felt like a goof for sharing the things I was able to share. How do you feel after writing these things down? Defeated and headed for ruination, but I will keep trying to get well. I don't have much choice. Anything you'd like to share with someone who shares your thoughts or experiences? I get the secrecy and shame. I get not feeling like a good person. Just don't cross over into territory you can't recover from. Thank you for sharing that. And I really, really urge you to give therapy another shot and to look into a support group for sex addiction, because this is serious. It might escalate, and it could really fuck up a lot of people's lives, but shaming yourself isn't going to help. The adult thing to do here is to ask for help, from qualified people and get honest with your therapist about the stuff that's going on, even if it's embarrassing. And I would find a therapist, if I were you, that specializes in sexual trauma and sexual addiction, because I have the feeling once you start processing the shit that happened in your childhood, it might open some doors into understanding your present day compulsions, and you might be able to develop some tools for coping so that you don't have to soothe your feelings by getting high, breaking laws, or violating somebody's privacy. So that's my two cents, but thank you for your honesty. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by spoiler alert, no one cares. And she writes, my future mother-in-law is the one person in my life who actually asks me how I am doing, which I frequently appreciate. My fiancé and I are in the process of buying a house, which has been extremely stressful for me, so she sent me a text. How have you been doing? I answered literally, I've been really snippy recently and I'm struggling with my mental health, so my doctor put me on a new medication. Also, I still have chronic hives, and I think I need to go see an endocrinologist. I might have Hashimoto's. My mother-in-law answered with, have you ever read the book Don't Sweat the Small Stuff? Yeah, Hashimoto's, small stuff. Oh my God. Thank you for that. And for those of you that are new listeners, awfulsome is a word we use to describe something that is both awesome and awful. This is a snapshot from someone's life from the Struggle in a Sentence survey. And it's a guy who calls himself Talking to Myself. And he writes, my beautiful girlfriend of 4 years and I have been living together for 2 years. And things have been great for most of our relationship, but something isn't right with the woman I love. She is distant, uncompassionate, and easily angered. May be resentful of the status of stay-home mom. I know that she struggles with her first pregnancy and did everything on her own, including work. And over the years, I've assumed many of the roles she once had. And then it continues, and it's basically a really, really tense situation. And he's been trying to offer his wife help, and she snaps at him, and she's irritable, and et cetera, et cetera. And he writes, I don't know how much longer I can go feeling my words are unheard. I love my family and want nothing but to spend time together, but I spend all my time cleaning and arguing. And I just want to offer the thought that this could be something related to your wife's pregnancy and hormones, because I've interviewed a lot of therapists on this show talking about postpartum depression, and there is also what do they call it? Perinatal depression? All stages of pregnancy can hormonally affect not only the woman, but the man. And my recommendation would be really encourage her to go talk to her OBGYN to start with, and then maybe a psychiatrist, or maybe you guys go to joint counseling together to talk about this. But I would not try to do this on your own. And my hunch is, if your wife is really irritable, it might be a real struggle to get her to see that she's changed. Because one of the fucked up things about mental illness is sometimes we're the last ones to see that we have become, you know, a load to be around. So it's, sending you some love and good vibes, man. But I can't imagine how hard that is. I can't. This is a shame and secret survey filled out by a woman who calls herself Perpetually 12 and Sad. And she is bisexual in her, she's 22. And she was raised in a totally chaotic environment. She writes, both of my parents were alcoholics who drank themselves to death. And then subsequently, my sister committed suicide. She hung herself in the closet of the bedroom we shared and I found her. I've been sad for my entire life and I just want to be happy, but I don't know how. She was also the victim of sexual abuse and never reported it. She writes, per my aunt, my dad molested me as a child, though thankfully I have no recollection of it. I remember always feeling scared of him and never wanting to be around him, though, which makes me feel like she's telling the truth. He also had prior arrests related to child sexual abuse that I've only just found out about as I've gotten older. She's been obviously emotionally abused. My parents were very emotionally abusive. They were both alcoholics and they were essentially two adult babies trying to raise three kids. They fought constantly, tried to kill each other in front of us multiple times, used all of us against each other. And I think the worst thing I can recall is when my mom found out that she was dying, she found out she had alcoholic cirrhosis and not much longer to live. She came home one night drunk as fuck, climbed into bed with me and started to ask me where I wanted to live after she died. Fuck. I was just a kid. The mere thought of her dying made me burst into tears and I just kept saying, "What? I don't want to live anywhere but with you." And she just kept yelling at me that I didn't have a choice and I had to pick someone to live with. And then she leaned in and said, "I'm dying, but you can't tell anybody. I mean it, anybody." And so I didn't. And she died. I don't think it would have mattered if I told anyway. This is one of the heaviest surveys I've read. Any positive experiences with the abusers? I have lots of positive memories of both of my parents, which makes everything really hard. I hate them so much, but I also miss them a lot, and I find myself feeling very empty about how things ended with both of them. I never got any closure, I guess. Darkest thoughts. I think about killing myself in many different ways. I daydream about it, and it relaxes me. I often turn to these ideations in times of high anxiety, because picturing myself dead makes me feel so good and calm and safe. I've been fantasizing about dying since I was 7 years old. Darkest secrets. I've been cheating on my significant other of 8 years with one of our mutual friends. It started a few years ago and I can't stop. I'm scared to walk away from either of them because I'm afraid of being alone. I feel like the worst person on the planet. Sexual fantasies most powerful to you. I think about having sex with women. It's something I've never done. I feel like that's a pretty normal thing to fantasize about. I think about pegging sometimes too. I think that would be exhilarating. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? I would like to tell my significant other the truth about me having an affair. I wish I could, but there are so many other lives involved that I can't. If it were just me and a stranger, I know I would do it in a heartbeat, but it's me and our friend, a friend we've shared since we were 14. Our lives have been intertwined for so long. I've been lying to so many people for so long. I don't know how to come back from this or how I'll ever make it right. What, if anything, do you wish for? I wish to be happy and fulfilled by myself. I want to love myself so much that I am all I need. Have you shared these things with others? My wishes? Yeah, I've talked about it a lot with friends and family, and they seem to think I'm very capable of being happy alone, but I don't think they realize how toxic my brain is and how much I absolutely hate being alone with myself. How do you feel after writing these things down? I'm not sure. Is there anything you'd like to share with someone who shares your thoughts or experiences? If you could direct me to some episodes possibly pertaining to coping with grief / loss of parents / suicide, etc., that would be helpful. I feel alone a lot of the time. It's been really hard being in this state of wanting to die but not wanting to die because I've experienced the pain of losing someone to suicide, and I don't want to do that to my family again. But then there's also a part of me that doesn't give a fuck anymore. I feel lost and scared and doomed. I saw a therapist for the first time yesterday and took some surveys and filled out some paperwork, and she was so alarmed with my scores, she started calling different outpatient facilities to see if they would take my insurance, and it scared me so badly. I've never talked to anyone like that before. I didn't know what to expect, but she seemed so disturbed after only talking to me for 20 minutes. She actually asked me, "How are you still here?" And I wanted to say, "I ask myself that question every day," but I didn't. I went to school. I had a 4.0 the whole time, graduated, got a great job at a hospital. I make pretty decent money. I have a house and a dog and a boyfriend that looks like a Calvin Klein model. Everything sounds really good on paper, but I'm miserable. I can't enjoy anything good that I have. Thank you so, so much for pouring your soul out into this survey, and I'm so, so sorry for all of the fucking trauma that you have had to experience. And my God, who wouldn't? Who wouldn't feel the way that you did, the way you do after all that you have been through? And, as I was reading it, I was thinking to myself, my God, this woman is a fucking survivor, that she is still functioning, and you clearly have an ability to compartmentalize painful things in your life and get up and go to work. But that stuff is like, it's like rust. It begins to spread. And I think you're feeling that. And the fact that you reached out to see a therapist is fantastic. And I really, really encourage you, to do that. And if you don't feel comfortable with this therapist, find another one and keep looking until you find one that you feel safe with, and then share everything with that therapist, and it can save your life. It did with me. I compartmentalized all of the shit that happened to me in my life. And it was killing me. And I'm so glad that I finally asked for help. And that's not unique to me. I know hundreds of people who've had terrible, terrible upbringings and live in a constant state of not wanting to be alive. And they eventually find the type of help that works for them, and they get better, be it a support group or therapy or seeing a psychiatrist, whatever it is. But it's a lot of trial and error and being patient with yourself. And I guess that's what I want to say more than anything, is be kind to yourself, because this is going to sound cheesy as fuck, but that little girl that had such a fucked up childhood is still inside you, and it is scared. And I think it relates to the fear of intimacy and the cheating. I think it's all tied together. Who would trust after what you've been through? Who would want to experience letting someone get close, really close, after what you've been experienced, after what you went through in your childhood? But we can get to the place where we trust again, where we can be intimate and faithful with someone, but it takes a lot of work. So what I'm saying is the things that you are doing aren't a reflection of who you are morally. They are the ways that you are coping with your pain, because you've compartmentalized it, and it's sitting there, and it's eating away at you. And it's just about finding a different way to deal with this pain and process it. And you can get to a place where you will feel self-love, and you will be okay being alone by yourself. And I know that, because I have experienced it, and I'm not bullshitting you. Sending you some love. This is a happy moment filled out by Patrick, the trans man from the previous couple of surveys ago. And he writes, I have a lot of trouble feeling my emotions and remembering good things. Mostly I dwell on my trauma and fears, and while that's not unusual, it is exhausting. I had a moment today at work where I went to grab myself coffee, and I felt myself relax. No thoughts in my brain, no words to describe how I felt, no internal narrator. I wasn't afraid of being attacked or analyzing every possible exit or weapon in my line of sight. I went outside, had a cigarette, and while I was there, I realized I was feeling something I'd been chasing my whole life. Peace. The feeling that I dream about when I picture myself sitting on a big porch at dusk, watching the fireflies glow lazily while a wind chime rings softly and my dog lays asleep at my feet. The feeling I fight for, trying to get the dog and the house and the good job so I can be at peace. But I was at peace. For the first time in years, I was at peace. I know I can get better, but I know worrying about it won't help. I can just exist and be okay. That's so beautiful. And then any comments to make the podcast better? He writes, also from the bottom of my heart, thank you for being supportive of the trans community. On my bad days, I remember the one time you read a survey I filled out and used he and him the whole time. It made my week, Paul. It made my fucking week. Oh, and try to be kind to yourself. You're doing so much good. That really made my day reading that. I made your week, but you made my day. So what I'm doing right there is I'm shortchanging you. Patrick, I'm telling you to go to fuck yourself. That's what I'm saying. No, but thank you. That means a lot to me. That really, really means a lot to me. When I started doing this podcast, I knew nothing about pronouns and binary, non-binary, the difference between sex and gender and sexuality. And I still stumble, but those of you that listen that are trans or non-binary have been so fucking supportive of me and helping to educate me in a way that was really compassionate and patient. And thank you right back. But fuck you, Patrick. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by Not Free to Be Me. And, she listed as an awfulsome moment, but honestly, to me, this one's a happy moment. And she writes, my great-grandmother was the only person in my life who truly loved me. When she passed away, I was so devastated, I just wanted to die so I could be with her. Her favorite animal was the owl, which was fitting since she was wise and beautiful like an owl. After she passed away, an owl would land on the fence in our backyard early, every evening. I'd look at it from the window, and I could feel my great-grandma's spirit, and I'd cry so hard. The owl visited me every day for 7 months. Then one day it flew away, and I never saw it again. My great-grandma knew how much I was grieving and how alone I felt. That owl helped me grieve the loss, and I got through it without trying to die. It made me smile because she was still protecting me even after she passed away. Thank you for that. You know, some people may roll their eyes at that, but I do believe that we are energy, and when our body passes away, we take on a different form, and who knows how the fuck that works, but I've heard too many people share stories like that. After my ex and I lost our dog, Herbert, those of you that are regular listeners know that he was a big part of the show, and me talking about him and his butthole. And there was a lizard that started coming around the day after he died and would come up to my ex every fucking day. And even if it's not true, it feels good. And ultimately, isn't that what matters? So what I'm saying is go out there and lie. Yes, that's my message. Be the biggest liars you can, and maybe you'll be befriended by a lizard. Oh, this took a terrible turn. Thank you, guys. I am I'm so grateful for the contributions of those of you that take the surveys and that send in the emails and say nice things. You know, there'll be days sometimes when I'm having a day where I'm in my head and I'm just thinking I'm a piece of shit. And then I'll get an email from somebody that, you know, mentions that the podcast helped them in some tiny way. And it reminds me that I am not my mistakes. And that's a nice feeling. So I hope you heard something, in this episode that resonated with you. And if you're out there and you're thinking about asking for help, but you're afraid, I encourage you to take that leap of faith. It's never as scary as our brain paints it. Just remember, you're not alone. And thanks for listening.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up
I know
in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up
I
in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up in some weird way.
Bizarrely